thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 59 for September 9th, 2010. Digital Replacements. Welcome back to Digital Campus, our back-to-school edition for 2010. Today on the podcast, we have our regulars, Dan Cohen from dancohen.org. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how's it going?
Going very well. And also Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Tom, how are you?
Great.
Good. Good. Welcome back to another exciting semester at George Mason. We also have two of our podcast irregulars, Amanda French. Amanda, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Mills.
Good, good. And from the frozen northlands of Vermont, we have also Brian Alexander from Knightley. Brian, how are things in Vermont?
Just fine. Fall has begun.
We're all jealous because it certainly has not begun here. And the great hurricane that was supposed to come up the East Coast and break our heat wave here in Washington, I think, has skipped us. So it's going to continue to be summer-like here as opposed to fall-like. So as we often do on Digital Campus, we stop just before the beginning of the semester, although our semester began a few days ago and a week and a half ago, I guess, and reflect on the kinds of things that we think are going to be happening on campus, the sort of new big stories. And I want to begin by one that I noticed just the other day. And that is, and it's kind of an alarming story, I think, and that is, you may have heard about the phenomenon of text walking, and certainly you've seen it, people walking around with their phones in front of their faces, and they're texting people, and they're kind of hazard, sort of unguided missiles. And now there's a new phenomenon caused by the upsurge in smartphones on campus, which is an increase in the number of head injuries from students crashing into each other as they're walking around campus watching YouTube on their smartphones. Okay, that hasn't really happened, but I'm convinced that it's going to happen.
Well, so, Dan, remember that time we were walking back from the cafeteria and I sprained my ankle because I was talking to you and walking downstairs and checking my email all at the same time?
I know, that was like a serious injury. That
laid you
up.
Yeah, it really did.
It's going to be right up there with sprained thumb from too much texting. But
see, I'm already klutzy enough already, so I'm wondering if actually the fact that I read my email on my phone while I'm walking might actually help with my bashing things.
Yeah, I have to admit, I feel kind of bad about this issue because not long ago I was on a staircase here at George Mason and a woman was walking down the stairs in front of me while texting. And I said to her, first of all, she was going too slow. And I said to her, you know, texting and walking downstairs is probably not the greatest idea. And she looked up at me and said, sorry? And she dropped her phone and it broke into about five pieces. So it turns out it wasn't a great idea and that the problem was me pointing that out to her.
Mills, did you ever get that smartphone you were
No, you know, I still haven't, although I think, you know, my older son starts high school on Tuesday and he's pretty much made it plain to his parents that if we don't upgrade our phones before Tuesday, he will not be attending high school. So I think this weekend could actually be the moment where Mills Kelly gives up the clamshell and gets a smartphone. And I think I'm probably going to end up staying on the Android side of the world. So as much as I dislike my current phone plan, I think because of just convenience factors, I'm probably going to end up staying with that. So we'll see. Next podcast, we'll ask Mills about his smartphone. Okay, so while we're thinking about young people and technology on campus, you know, for so many years, one of the topics that we've spent who knows how many minutes or hours on this podcast has been Facebook. And just the other day, there was a story in the Wired Campus section of the Chronicle of Higher Education on Facebook's Brian Zuckerberg, or Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, trying to reconnect with Facebook's core constituents, the students on campus. And it seems to me that when a big corporation has to try to reconnect with its core constituency, that's a recognition by the big corporation that they're in trouble with that core constituency. Brian, what do you think about this?
I think it's probably overblown. I mean, all the trend lines for Facebook are still continuing to go up. There are a lot of anecdotal reports about students being unhappy with the way that faculty or staff use Facebook on campus. But beyond the occasional New York Times story of, I interviewed one person, he said this, there doesn't seem to be much evidence for it. One way of looking at it is that there's no replacement. I mean, students aren't migrating to MySpace 2.0. They're certainly not going to. It's very, very stable so far.
So you don't think Diaspora is going to push Facebook aside?
It could, but we're not looking. I mean, they're looking at a code release on the 15th. So I mean, it's still very, very early days. I mean, we'd have to return to this probably in January to see if Diaspora goes anywhere. And if they do, they're going to be starting from scratch. I mean, they're going to have to grow stuff up. I mean, they don't have the Apple advantage that we saw this week with Ping, where you already have iTunes users already, you know, set to go with iTunes 10. Diaspora would have to start from the beginning. I mean, they do have one possible rhetorical advantage. It's already being talked about with some enthusiasm from technologists, but more importantly, you'll see phrases like safe alternative to Facebook, the better privacy option for than Facebook. So that might be a way to get a leg up. Whether or not students will use it, that's going to be an open question.
Well, right, and all indications are that that students and people of that age group aren't concerned about the privacy implications of Facebook. So, you know, I mean, that rhetorical advantage, I mean, it's certainly going to work on me because I am concerned about Facebook and privacy, but I just don't think it's going to resonate with that core constituency.
Yeah, this past week, a few different email lists have been lit up with a lot of concern about Facebook and privacy. The New Media Consortium email list, for example, had a pretty large consensus that Facebook was bad for privacy. But as you say, that doesn't seem to impact their bottom line of user base, which just keeps growing.
Although I will say, I've been spending more time than I usually do on Facebook because I've just taken over one of our big undergraduate majors here at Mason, and we had no Facebook presence, which we clearly needed. And so as students have been then signing on to our Facebook page, I've been clicking on their icon to see, you know, who is this person. And the vast majority of them are, you know, blockaded. It's just, here's the profile picture, and this person has chosen not to share their information. So I'm seeing a lot more, a lot more sort of closing down of privileges, at least from students at George Mason. Whether that's a bigger trend or not, I have no idea.
I think I, you know, read a study somewhere. As usual, it's faded into the file cabinet of my mind, which study where. But that said that, in fact, younger users are not so much aware of and concerned about their privacy, but that they're better able to control it than people in, you know, sort of more older demographics. And I actually remember really clearly back in, roughly 2004, 2005, teaching my students that, hey, anyone with an EDU account can get a Facebook account, which means that your professors can see what you're putting on Facebook, and having that be kind of, you know, a shock and something that they needed to learn, and a little privacy lesson in itself. Well, now they know that what they're putting on Facebook is likely to be public. You know, it's almost the same as being public on the web. So,
yeah, I remember that same moment when I said that to my students, and one of them, her eyes kind of widened, and she looked at me and she said, "Seriously?" And I said, "Yes." And then she said, "Ooh." So this
gets directly to my marketing plan for Diaspora. I've been thinking about this because I think, you know, the problem is this is one of these natural monopolies that you have on the internet, like eBay had. I think Facebook is sort of a natural monopoly, just because, you know, well, all your friends are there and you're in high school and you go to college. I mean, are you really going to disconnect from that and go somewhere else? So I was thinking the way that Diaspora should do this is, I mean, it is open source, but they might want to run a hosted service that markets just to campuses, for students at universities, as a kind of underground network, you know, like, or a club network that's only for students. Mm-hmm. So they get back to the original thing where people could know, because they're going to limit it just to students, that, you know, this is a place where you can post crazy photos and things like that. And that's their tack, is we're not going to let anyone else in. And they run, let's say, mason.diaspora.com or whatever they do, or someone else does it since they're open sourcing the server code. But you make it, you know, Club Mason opening in January 2011, students only, you know, set up your profile now.
How do you restrict it only to students?
That's a good question, but there's ways you could do it.
I mean, that's what Facebook did. I mean, Facebook was able to build the network effects that it has now by first targeting the student demographic. I mean, if they had let students and parents on at launch, that I don't think they would have been able to displace MySpace. It was by making it an exclusive, sort of an exclusive thing, that allowed them to build enough of a network to then, when they did open it to everybody, have the necessary momentum to push past the existing options, which at the time were, you know, very robust. Interesting, Dan.
Well, yeah. but of course, Diaspora is being built by college students, right? There's NYU students, and Mark Zuckerberg even put some money into the project because he said that they reminded him of himself back when he was a student at Harvard developing Facebook, you know.
Which reminded me of Microsoft buying shares in Apple too.
Right. Yeah, I think Dan's point is a really good one, because the cachet of Facebook initially was that it was a place where it was a sandbox that students could play in without grown-ups. And this is why, you know, my student had that ooh reaction, is because all of a sudden it turned out grown-ups were in the same sandbox. And the now Facebook has been taken over by grown-ups. And I'm sure that the vast majority of their users are not students, and because they have too many. There are too many Facebook users for the majority to be students any longer. And so there's got to be a point where young people say, we need a place without grown-ups. And so I think if it's not Diaspora, I think before too much longer, we're going to see some other kind of off to the side space. I think Tom's right as well, though, that, or maybe it was Dan, that Facebook does have this kind of natural monopoly I don't think people are going to disconnect from Facebook anytime soon, but this other space, maybe the network that they
right,
go
but
and play
it
in.
Could end up being this kind of lame, you know, AOL husk where students post their, like, hey mom, here's me playing soccer, you know, all the like lily white stuff goes on Facebook, right?
Right.
And maybe some stuff, since all these things will have APIs, maybe some stuff gets forwarded from Diaspora. Hmm. But all the juicy stuff goes on Mason Underground, you know, and it's just limited to Mason students, or it could be an invite only thing to restrict it. But you just, you know, you put a rope in front, you know, sort of velvet rope kind of thing, and get the graphics right, and don't make it all clean like Facebook is now. And you just attack that market. I mean, clearly Facebook had some way to restrict it just to students. I have no idea how they did it.
I know exactly how they did it. They did it. They didn't exactly restrict it only to students, but you had to have a .edu email address
right.
to sign up. So they marketed it to students, and then you had to have a .edu address, which of course meant that some faculty could do it. But I think that's kind of an interesting, like, you could still do that, but I know that there, at least some people think that universities should stop giving .edu addresses out. Because people already have email when they go in, and why do they need a dedicated email once they get to university? But
right.
Well, and don't even get the Mason folks on this podcast started about the university changing all the student email addresses during the first week of the semester.
You didn't even want to bring that up.
Yeah.
I was deliberately trying.
I know you were trying to provoke us on that. So
well, let's go sideways from it then. What do you think of the possibility of Google Me being such a place? I mean, because they already have the widespread installed user base of Gmail accounts. I mean, this is a hypothetical project, a rumor project, but if Google releases such a thing, I mean, that could serve that way.
I just think there's nothing in their past history that suggests Google knows how to do social.
Right.
You know, they've tried Orkut.
Yep.
It's a flop, except in Brazil and India. They've tried Buzz, flop.
Epic flop.
Yeah, they've tried many times.
Lively.
Lively flop. I mean, they've tried this and they never seem to get it right. I think the culture of Google is just too focused on engineering to understand. And maybe it's the engineers just, you know, aren't social enough people to understand what it takes to build that kind of social network. So I mean, we'll see. I mean, Google certainly has the reach and the resources and the technical expertise to build something, a Facebook competitor. But it's whether they get the atmospherics and the marketing and all of that right. That's I think remains to be seen.
Well, maybe it's a mistake to think of it as one platform, one single platform, like MySpace was. And, of course, this is a great opportunity for MySpace if they want to try it. But maybe it'll be segmented out. I mean, take a look at the Microsoft gaming environment, for example. I mean, they've been growing that base very carefully. There's a big appeal to teenagers, and they have persistent identities. So I can imagine, and that's definitely below the radar for almost anybody. I can imagine that serving as one segment of a kind of George Mason Underground, connecting students, and then maybe another gaming company. I mean, that might be a case where Facebook as a home for social games might play a role. And then maybe Yahoo or PopCap. You know, I can imagine that growing level by level. And gaming so far remains beneath the radar of definitely academics.
So, you know, I think it remains to be seen what exactly is going to happen with all these possibilities. But for the moment, we're definitely stuck with Facebook. It is the platform that is out there. I'm feeling a little nostalgia just by the number of times I've heard the words MySpace in a sentence today, because I can't remember the last time somebody said MySpace to me. So that was kind of fun. Brian, from up there in Vermont, what else do you see coming down the pike this fall for our back to school listeners?
Well, mobile ramping way up is just a big, big issue. We ran a prediction market on mobile devices for the past 2.5 years, and the value for that kept going way, way up. And every campus we've talked to follows that. Every campus has followed that trend. They all are trying to figure out how to create mobile sites. They're all interested in exploring iPads. This is only the iPad issue is new. The smartphone issue is pre-existing but ramped up in greater quantity. So do you make a mobile site or do you make apps, for example? If you make apps, which platform do you make them for? And mobile is just growing very, very large. I think the biggest constraint is simply cost right now. That we're still in the recession, and it's hard to divert money for that. But mobile is one major, major issue.
So for those of you who have smartphones, have you noticed any sort of bandwidth problems on campuses?
My problem with the mobile device on campus is the onerous restrictions that at least our campus, and I know other campuses, place on getting onto the network. I mean, you know, George Mason, to get onto the wireless network on campus, well, you know, which, you know, we have sort of ubiquitous Wi-Fi, but to get on the Wi-Fi network around campus, you know, you have to launch this, like, you know, this like Java portal that, you know, you have to log into, and you have to, and my, you know, my email password, you know, that they now make your email, you know, you have to have numbers and letters and uppercase and lowercase and special characters and all this stuff in your password. So it makes it very hard to type your password on a smartphone device where you're constantly having to switch keyboards and go to alt keys and stuff. I mean, it's just like a pain in the neck to get on the network on the smartphone. So, you know, I almost never use the Wi-Fi on campus with my phone. I'm almost always on the 3G, the wireless, the cell signal. So, and I've got a good signal on campus, so it works for me. But the restrictions on the Wi-Fi networks on campuses, I think, are a hindrance, especially to visitors. If they want,
definitely.
If the admissions office, for instance, wants to provide a mobile tour for visitors or something, that's going to be, just the difficulty of getting on a Wi-Fi network on campus is going to create problems there.
Do any campuses still have open networks?
Yeah, I was at Kansas State University last spring, and Kansas State has defined open wireless access as a public good. And so there's a dome over the campus, and if you're within, I think probably about a half a mile, because I was the bed and breakfast I was staying in was about a half a mile away from campus, and the signal from K State was stronger than the signal from the router in the B&B. And so I was on the K State network, and it was a perfectly strong signal, and I was talking to people there, and they made the decision a number of years ago that free open wireless access was a public good, and they were the land-grant university for the state, and they were going to provide it. And so the community of Manhattan, Kansas, the Little Apple, they have free wireless access courtesy of the university. And you can either put in your password if you want to have access to, the registration system or something like that, or you just type in guest and your password is guest. It's pretty simple.
It just seems like there was this, over the past 5 years or so, this sort of internal issue with security and all the concerns that administrators have, that all these things got locked down, and not only locked down, but locked down in really horrific ways. I think most of them are this, you got to fire up a web browser thing, which is incredibly annoying.
That's what I see in most campuses.
Phones, yeah, and a lot of phones don't handle that process very well.
Well, but it kind of cuts both ways, because if you can't get on the Wi-Fi at a university, then that's double the reason to use your mobile device and use 3G on that. So in one way, it's not being able to get on Wi-Fi makes it a little bit harder to use your mobile device, because some people, some of the versions of the iPad only come with Wi-Fi and all that, but it makes it's a good reason to have a mobile device that has 3G.
Well, that was one of the advantages of the Kindle for a while, using the phone network, WhisperNet, not having to worry about Wi-Fi. Dan, many campuses still have lockdowns at different levels. I mean, the highest would be something like running Cisco's, what's that program called? Clean Access, No Access, whatever it's called. but it's such a really high bar. Last summer, I was visiting one campus, and the IT staff said, yeah, well, we basically don't want people on our network from off campus, which I won't tell you what school it was, but I admired their honesty. And that attitude really comes forth. But I think maybe Amanda's got it. People will leapfrog. Wi-Fi will become a kind of or lockdown Wi-Fi can become a kind of legacy, and people will bypass and go to 3G. And then
I'm guessing, though, that 14. The 3G, for instance, Brian, where you are, is probably not all that good.
Well, where I am right now, we don't have any.
For especially for a lot of small campuses, a lot of the campuses that you serve, that's going to be the case. The small liberal arts colleges isolated communities. And
Texas Christian University, when they did their iPhone initiative, they actually had to build towers to guarantee a baseline of service. And they weren't really doing rich media. I mean, they weren't all pulling down videos and playing them. They just had to make sure they had decent coverage. I mean, that's part of larger American telecom infrastructure, which is still pretty weak. The leapfrog is not a perfect one. I think that's a developmental one. Mm-hmm.
Although, I do think there's some interesting things that can happen when you do expect always on and easy access, where there's really no friction and you can assume everyone on campus who has a device is kind of on the network. Things that you can do with students, things you can do with visitors. And I wonder if administrators are being a little short-sighted by locking all these things down. Even on the bypass, I mean, as you were just saying, Brian, the cost of a monthly subscription to these 3G plans, it's pretty pricey for a student. The device price is now a very small part of that. So I do see a lot of students out there with iPhones and Android devices and things like that, but we're not, I don't think we're yet at the point, given the cost of all that and given the difficulty with access, that you can assume, you know, more than half your students are, wherever they are on campus, will have a device that's active right now.
Well, yeah. One thing to do is to find that out. And I mean, there's no real uniformity across the U.S. So quite a few campuses are talking about doing inventories, surveys, polls, some kind of analysis of their population, because it just like, you know, we sometimes have campuses that are all Mac versus some that are almost all PC. I mean, you just get that, but multiplied by the greater diversity of the cell phone market.
Well, and I will say, too, I was at NYU last year. And I mean, yeah, the difficulties of getting guests onto the wireless network were not to be believed. And they were, you know, only slightly more onerous than, you know, getting onto the wireless network if you worked at NYU, you know, or were a student. But I will, you know, so I complained about this, and they said, well, you know, we're in a really urban environment. And, you know, I do a little bit buy that their security issues are worse than if you're, you know, out in a cornfield in the Midwest somewhere. So,
but
you know,
I've seen that at cornfield campuses too, which always amazes me.
Yeah, right.
I was I gave a talk on a campus just recently, and it turns out that, you know, I couldn't get onto the wireless, and the reason was that the IT staff had made the decision that there would be no further guest access to their wireless network, that this was the simple and clean way to approach it, and that, and they further, when the staff said, okay, one of the staff members from the Teaching, Learning, and Technology Center said, okay, well, I'll just log you in on my account. Then that didn't work either, because he was already logged in somewhere else, and they, you know, the IT staff had already thought of that, so they weren't going to let people just log guests in on their account. So essentially, he had to go down to his office, get his laptop, bring it back to the place where I was giving the talk about technology and teaching, and then, you know, log me in that way. They were a little embarrassed about it, but they said, you know, that's the decision that's been made on our campus.
I've actually been doing a little Googling about this, and this is a great research topic for somebody. If there are any graduate students listening, I would love to know not only which universities do offer open Wi-Fi, but what effect that has on, you know, the way the university is perceived or the work that goes on there, that kind of thing. But in doing this Googling, I've come across a story from back in February about a UK bill that would outlaw open Wi-Fi. Now, this bill hasn't been passed yet, but specifically saying that in the UK, they wouldn't exempt universities or libraries or other places that might conceivably be interested in offering open Wi-Fi for the public good. They too would come under this law if it passed.
That, you know, I think it remains to be seen where we're going with this. I think the optimistic interpretation that I can offer, though, is that just 3 or 4 years ago here at George Mason, when we had nothing remotely resembling ubiquitous Wi-Fi, I was trying to get a wireless signal in my office, which was a long way from the nearest router, and I complained to somebody in the dean's office, and they said, well, you know, your department can set up their own routers, and here's how much that costs. And of course, departments weren't going to put the money into that, and because we didn't have the money to put into it. And so now, slowly but surely, the university's stuck routers up all over the place because students were not happy at not being able to connect. So I think sort of pressure from below will help solve some of this. And Amanda, when you and I were talking earlier today, you mentioned a story you'd seen about e-books replacing used books in a campus bookstore. You want to tell us a little more about that?
Sure, yeah. This is a story that just came out today about a Daytona State College moving to all ebooks for its textbooks. And, you know, if you are moving to all ebooks, I don't know, you know, what Daytona State College's Wi-Fi access is like, but I think that would be really annoying if you know, didn't offer good Wi-Fi and required only ebooks. That would not be good. But, we were talking a little bit about trends for the coming year. And I mean, you know, it's been a trend for the last 10 years, but yet again, ebooks are the new black. They're coming in. They never go away, never go out of style, but as the new thing, but they're, you know, for-profit universities have been doing this. They've been requiring all their students to use ebooks. And it's an interesting article. I won't go into all the details of Daytona State's plan for going to ebooks, but just to sum it up, they say that students will save as much to 80% on course materials. They say that the university will save money in various ways, you know, that it's good for their students. And they also say that it's not going to harm professor choice into what they can assign, because they can choose different, you know, professors can choose different publishers from within the department to essentially get a sort of site license for all their books for. So, and I'm so skeptical. I really don't see how ebooks could possibly be cheaper except in the short term, because of this, the same kind of licensing trouble that we've seen with scholarly journal articles, I think at some point is going to kick in with ebooks. Now the university, you know, Daytona State University says that, well, the only thing that this is going to harm is the university bookstore on campus. You know, that it's going to kill the used book market, which is very, very profitable for university bookstores. But it's profitable for students too. You know, I mean, they buy some books, which are really, really expensive, but they do recoup some of the prices. Now, you know, and this article says, well, but they won't have to spend as much money up front because the ebooks are cheaper. That may be true right now. I really doubt that that's going to be true farther down the line once everybody moves to ebooks. I think that people are going to be able to jack up the price as much as they want. And because they control, you know, how and whether you can access that ebook, they're going to feel free to charge a lot.
Well, it's also a financial problem for institutions. If the market, the amount of money students are spending on books goes down, then, you know, bookstores are an income center for campuses all around the country. And so if student spending on books goes down, then money coming from those bookstores, whether they're franchise operations or, you know, or big companies like Barnes & Noble running the campus bookstore, or the institution running its own bookstore, that's going to be a loss of income that the institution's going to have to make up from somewhere.
Yeah, but I don't know how much income universities actually make off that. I mean, they you know, it's private companies, right, that run these bookstores, and I don't know, there's some kind of profit sharing thing that goes on, but essentially the university, you know, back when print was the only game in town, it was good for universities to have some private company run its bookstore, because you needed to make sure that the assigned books were available to students. But now with Amazon and with, you know, all kinds of easy ways to get even, you know, cheap print books, it's not the best deal for universities anymore, I think, or for students. It's not, you know, students don't have to get their books at the university bookstore. They don't, you know, necessarily want to. So I think it's a legacy arrangement that I would like to see go away, but I don't think that moving to all ebooks right now is necessarily the way to do it.
Has anyone looked at CourseSmart? I was doing a little research on this topic, and there's a site called CourseSmart, which has agreements with all the major textbook producers. So in history, for instance, they've got 426 history textbooks. It's sort of all the main history textbooks you want for American History 101, European History, World History, etc. And the prices are like a third of the print edition prices. It's just for, I mean, it's clear that they're very optimized for iPad. They, you know, that's the device they show all these things running on. They've got an app for the iPad and the iPhone. And, you know, I was doing some calculations on this, and you can actually essentially get your iPad for free if you do a year's worth of courses using CourseSmart. And not only that, what's I think even more intriguing is that they actually rent textbooks, e-textbooks, for 180 days. So if you don't want to buy it, it's even less. And so you have textbooks that are $100 or $120 or even $150 for, you know, $48 for 180-day rental. And it seems to me like, you know, you marketed this, you could tell a student, hey, you know, this is going to pay itself off in 1 year. And you're going to get all the textbooks, and it has
and an iPad,
Yeah, right. And it's got sticky notes and a highlighter and all that stuff, which, you know, a lot of students don't use anyway.
Well, yeah, but it's I don't think it's a free market for students, because that's only useful for them if their textbook is offered in CourseSmart. And if, you know, so if they do have a big selection, and if it is, then yeah, that would work. But really, it's faculty that you have to get invested in stuff like that. You know, there are some faculty who've done, I think, Mills, didn't you teach a course where you only required Wikipedia, or that,
yep.
maybe that was somebody
yep.
else?
No, that was me.
Right. So if you get
sounds like those.
Yeah. who are interested in, you know, only assigning free or cheap or electronic books.
Oh, right. No, I'm personally much more in favor of that. I'm just, you know, being a realist on it, the shortcut is always to assign a textbook on these kinds of large introductory courses. And it seems to me that the economics on that, the on-campus Barnes & Noble imprint, is in big trouble, I think, with these kinds of apps. And I assume that they make them for Kindle or these other devices as well.
Yeah, because I had a conversation with our Barnes & Noble folks a few years ago, and they were explaining to me that for them, at least at our local store, that the real profit was in the used book market. And so if the e-books kill off the used book market, there will be some – I think the publishers will have some they'll be happy about that in a particular way, and that is that you know, it's the used book market that threatens to kill off the textbook market all the time. And so if the publishers have figured out a way to then kill the used book market with ebooks, then boy, is that going to make them smile. The other piece I think that will be attractive, especially to campuses like ours, is that the same kind of thing that's come up with libraries is that books take up a lot of space and ebooks don't. And our campus is just always short on space. And so if we could, for instance, reclaim the entire downstairs of our campus bookstore where all the books are stored for sale and use that for – that could be carved up into four classrooms. Boy, could we use that space.
If only you could turn into a parking garage, you'd win the faculty.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. That's exactly
right. Thinking about the iPad focus for a second, I mean, on the one hand, it sounds really appealing because of the enormous buzz around the iPad. On the other hand, you're still talking about a serious capital investment. I mean, you're talking about, you know, $500, $600, $700 for the iPad. And the recession, I wonder, back and forth, which it's like with the Kindle, right? This is very similar to the business model of the Kindle, where it pays itself back in time. It saves space, which matters for the students as much as for the faculty. But it's still that initial investment.
Yeah, but those are going to get cheaper. And I still think we're, you know, a few years out from the real ebook revolution. But I do think that we have seen it start in the last year with, you know, increasingly cheap Kindles and the iPad, which everybody says is, you know, they're surprised at how well that's doing as an ebook reader. And apparently the books that you can get through iTunes are doing really well, too, although I don't think there are.
Well, not as many as you can for the Kindle app.
I think this is actually a perfect opportunity for our listeners to weigh in once we get this posted up on the website, because I would love to hear from people how many of Digital Campus listeners are already assigning ebooks in their courses, not just, you know, links to a source online, but an actual ebook. I would love to hear from people on that, because I still don't know, but except one or two people who are using ebooks in the small field of history that I play around in. While we're on the subject of ebooks,
final word on this?
Sure.
So this is the black ops version of this. So what happens when, okay, so the students, the iPad goes down to $99 in 2 years or whatever, but students start trading PDFs of their expensive $100 textbooks on the web.
They do already. I understand.
I know. No, I know they do.
Yeah.
And students figured out Napster really quickly. I mean, the average student book cost per semester is $400. How'd you like to save $400 a semester?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Book torrent. So I think
we're going to be talking about this more. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah. Right. No, but you know, in a way that's good, because if you do, you know, the what happens with the music industry, I mean, you know, granted piracy is still rampant in the music industry, but there is a really good legal alternative in iTunes and in plenty of other places that people use. So I think that publishers may see it to their advantage to maybe not yank people around so much on the ebook prices if things like CourseSmart and other things serve as a good alternative to piracy. You know, I mean, which would you rather do? Offer a, as a publisher, offer a cheap electronic version that people can actually buy, or jack up your prices a lot and have people pirate it because the price is too high. So, the piracy market will hopefully keep prices down, because that's what I'm most worried about with moving to ebooks is high prices.
Because I think that's right, because I think that the typical person, the average person, whoever that person might be, would prefer to do things legally as opposed to wandering around in book torrents somewhere or some other way of evading the price. There are lots of people who want it for free, and I think the number of young people who want things for free and only for free will continue to grow. But I still think the average consumer of digital materials would prefer to do it the right way, and certainly, iTunes has proved that there is a very large market for people who are willing to pay a low price to stay on the legal side as opposed to the black ops side. While we're on the subject of ebooks, something that's been floating around the blogosphere just very recently is the end of the digital publishing initiative at Rice University Press. Dan, you were the one who brought this to our attention. You want to tell us a little more about what happened there?
Well, I wish I had more inside information, although if I did have inside information, I might not talk about it on the podcast. But I mean, it just sounds like an ugly and sort of poorly handled demise, if that is what it is, of Rice University Press, which if people have been following this story, Rice had already closed its press in the 90s, in 1996. It was one of these early presses to close. I think the economics have never been good around university presses, or actually presses in general. The economics have never been very good, unless you happen to have, Stephen King on your roster. But the press had been sort of remade and relaunched in about 5 years ago as a digital-only press. So there was no print. I think they were trying to do all print-on-demand books and, experimenting with some sort of e-publishing possibilities. Rice also has Connections, which is a kind of platform for publishing scholarly works, that's open access. I think this was really, it was really truly an experiment. But it still required money from the provost's budget each year to maintain, I think largely for one FTE, one salary, which was the actual publisher, or editor, I should say, who was Fred Moody. And then I think some secondary costs, I assume space costs and things like that. Although actually even that was virtualized, right? I think Fred was not even on campus at Rice University.
Yeah, I think that's right.
That's right.
Right. So this is really an entirely new model. The plug was pulled as the provost, I think just sort of suddenly, and from what I gather from the advisory board for the press, it was really shocked by this as well. The provost just decided to zero out the money for, I guess, Fred's position and other secondary costs around the press. And this kind of, led to a couple things. It led to a lot of hand-wringing about, university presses in general, and second about, the digital experiments are bound to fail because look at what happened to Rice. And then I think some of the board members wrote blog posts and, spoke to the Chronicle and other media outlets about kind of what had happened. And I gave a kind of different story of it, which seemed a little bit more shady, that it didn't really seem like this thing had totally failed and it hadn't lost that much money and all these other things. So there's a lot of griping. We'll link to the griping from digitalcampus.tv in our links for the show notes. But, you know, I think it did at least raise this question of what the future of university presses are. I think correctly, the critics pointed out that moving to print on demand does not erase most of the costs. I mean, most of the costs in university press publishing are in acquisitions and editing, right? In other words, paying the salaries of people like Fred and acquisition editors. I mean, that's a huge cost for university presses. Very little of the cost is actually printing paper copies or maintaining files or those sorts of things. So I do understand that piece of it. I think the other part, though, is that I'm not really sure that Rice experimented enough. In other words, they weren't quite doing the things that I think some of the newer models, like what's going on at Michigan, where they moved the press into effectively a library unit. So it took away the profit incentive. They kind of made it de facto a kind of service body within the library that was funded in a different way. But that also gave them a lot of latitude to experiment with open publishing formats and new models of different sizes and shapes and editorial models, peer review models, all those things. I just think there hasn't been enough experimentation. And in this way, it kind of reminds me of the hand-wringing that happened after the dot-com bust, where people said, aha, you know, there are all these companies, and it just shows that the web world is, you know, not really made for sustainable businesses. And actually, when business professors look back on this, there's a great essay that we'll link to from the show notes from our friend David Kirsch, a business professor at University of Maryland, who actually looked at the dot-com bust, has done a lot of historical work on the rise of the dot-com world and what happened in 2000-2001. And he really looked at this carefully and found out that it was just that there was not enough experimentation. There was a lot of Me Too type businesses, and that actually, even within that, a lot of those businesses limped along and did okay after the market crash in 2001. So I just think it's just sort of too early to, you know, write a eulogy for new models for university presses. Obviously, they're in trouble, and I think another one, what was it, Scranton University Press, also crashed this month. But it was a strange little story that I think we're going to learn more about as the months go past.
I remember being really, really startled when I read about this to realize that Rice University Press, which sounds quite impressive, had one employee, you know, one full-time employee. It's like, gee, you know, a lot of what I've read about it said the administration was not really very committed to this at all. And that's pretty key. I mean, how can one guy be a university press?
Right. I mean, they had, I'm not going to give numbers, but their budget, their yearly budget for this press was the monthly budget here at CH&M.
Right.
So I'm not really sure how you run a university press on that kind of a budget.
Well, and I don't want to be too snarky about this, but the whole notion of print on demand for scholarly monographs is a little risible to me, just because, well, you know, nobody really wants to read scholarly monographs until they do, you know, until one of them, you know, somebody has been writing arcane things about the Taliban in Afghanistan, and that, you know, suddenly becomes very pertinent. But I think we've talked about it several times, but I still really love Kathleen Fitzpatrick's model of, you know, what people do demand with scholarly publishing is to disseminate their work to a wide audience and to have it vetted by professionals who can verify that this is really good work. And that second part is really something that the university itself should be interested in ensuring for its own employees. So basically, when Kathleen says, look, university presses should, as you say, become part of the library and should consider all this work of editing and peer review as quality assurance for its employees. You know, we want to make sure that our employees are putting out good work, that they're not, you know, putting wrong statements into the scholarly domain. And then we're going to make that available just, you know, to contribute to human knowledge. You know, that's the model I like.
Yeah, well, me too. I mean, it's just hard to get from here to there. And, you know, I wonder about sort of transitionary. I mean, the you know, the tyranny of the monograph for at least the humanities is really tough to overcome. And I think that some of these new models, it's the question of how you get the kind of proper support for, as you note, for kind of veracity review, although I don't think it has to be a pre-peer review because that is a tremendous amount of the cost for new monographs. But, you know, how do you get to a point where you could publish, let's say, everything open access in a scholarly environment?
Well, I think this is certainly not the end of anything here. I think, Dan, you're absolutely right that we are in a period of experimentation. Some of those experiments will succeed, some will fail. You know, I think that I'll point back to a piece that Clay Shirky wrote on his blog, where he said, and we'll link to it in the show notes. You know, where he said that you know, nothing will work. In he was referring to newspaper publishing, but I think it can apply equally to scholarly publishing. Nothing will work, but everything might, and that we're not going to know the solution until after it's already invented. You know, so we're in a period where everything is going to be broken for a while, and we need to kind of, I think in some ways embrace that we are at a period where scholarly communication is broken in many ways, and that there are lots of different possible replacements for the old model, but no one can really tell you right now which of those replacement models is going to be the winner, and I think that's okay. You know, I think we need to get over thinking that everything needs to be back in place, put back in its place immediately. You know, it's tough for the people who are going to, you know, lose jobs, and for institutions that are going to go by the wayside. But I think, you know, it's a tremendous period of opportunity and experimentation, and that's something that's going to be with us, I think, probably for, you know, 5, 10, even maybe 25 years. Certainly, when the printing press was invented, it took a long time for the forms that we know today to solidify and develop, and for persistent forms to become persist. So I think we should continue to talk about this, but it's not something anybody's gonna have the answer to anytime soon.
Well, one form of scholarly communication we know is working is the podcast, because we're all very pleased with ourselves here at Digital Campus. And
And
all you have to do, if you don't believe me that it's working, all you have to do is see how many Twitter stalkers we have. And, you know, I'm told that it's a pretty large number. It's amazing to me that I even have a few still. Even though I've never actually posted anything on Twitter. So who knows whether that particular form of scholarly communication will ever really become persistent, as Tom put it. But for now, it seems that the theme for our podcast, one of the advantages of being the host is that you get to sit back and listen to everybody else. And what we've been talking about today is all the things that are going to replace the things that we're used to, but just not right away. So... I guess our message for today is stay tuned, not only to the podcast, but to all these technological developments. So
the moral is the future is not now.
Exactly. The future is not now. And to find out when the future will be now, just keep listening to Digital Campus. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.